From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It was billed as the Rumble in the Jungle when Muhammad Ali and George Foreman met in Zaire in 1974 for a World Heavyweight Championship fight. That fight and the boxer's experiences in Africa is the subject of the new documentary When We Were Kings, which opens next week. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from George Foreman. He lost the title to Ali in 74, underwent a personal transformation several years later, and regained the title in 1994 at the age of 45. He since lost the title for refusing to fight one of his challengers. Also, film critic John Powers reviews Suburbia and Waiting for Guffman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. White House Budget Director Franklin Raines is on Capitol Hill today defending President Clinton's new budget. The spending plan is worth about $1.7 trillion. Senate Budget Chairman Pete Domenici says the document doesn't go far enough in cutting spending and taxes, but the New Mexico Republican says he wants to negotiate a deal with the White House. For his part, Budget Director Franklin Raines says the blueprint is the right starting point for discussion. GOP leaders hint they will insist, however, on tax cuts that are double the amount that President Clinton is proposing. With crime rates stubbornly high, the Washington, D.C. Police Union is asking the federal government to take over the police department, at least for 5 years. NPR's Barbara Bradley has more.
In most major cities, violent crime has dropped, often dramatically. Not so in the nation's capital, which is averaging more than a murder a day. The point was driven home earlier this week when a police officer was shot and killed while sitting in his patrol car. The police union says it will take at least $700 million to combat crime, in terms of manpower, equipment, and technology, but the D.C. government is bankrupt, so the union is asked to be absorbed into the U.S. Justice Department. D.C. Mayor Marion Barry doesn't like that idea and wants a compromise. According to a union spokesman, Barry would give up direct control of the police department and, in exchange, ask for a 5-year federal takeover. The mayor and the union are expected to make a joint statement about the matter next week. I'm Barbara Bradley in Washington.
German prosecutors say they've charged 3 Germans, 1 Palestinian and 1 Libyan in connection with a 1986 bomb attack on a West Berlin nightclub that was a hangout for American servicemen. 3 people died in the attack that triggered a U.S. airstrike. From Berlin, NPR's Edward Lifson reports.
Charges announced today against the 5 individuals include triple murder, 9 charges of attempted murder, causing an explosion, and aiding and abetting an attack. In 1986, 2 U.S. soldiers and a Turkish woman were killed at La Belle discotheque in West Berlin. Scores of off-duty U.S. military personnel and other nightclub goers were also injured. At the time, Washington blamed Libya for the blast. The U.S. bombed the Arab state in retaliation and killed at least 15 people and wounded more than 100. Today, the German state prosecutors named the Libyan Secret Service as the organization that gave the order to carry out the 1986 nightclub attack. The 2 non-Germans charged in the bombing today are a former member of the Libyan Secret Service and a Palestinian, both of whom worked at the Libyan embassy in East Berlin in 1986. In Berlin, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 73 points at 6,846. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, this just in, President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin will meet for a 2-day summit next month in Finland. The summit will take place on March 20th and 21st in Helsinki. Another proposed corporate merger is making news today, and pharmacies are the focus. CVS Corporation of Rhode Island plans to buy up Revco, which is headquartered in Ohio. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Revco is the nation's number 2 chain of drug stores. But it could become number 1 with 4,000 stores if CVS gets the go-ahead for a $2.8 billion merger. Last year, when the nation's number 1 drugstore chain, Rite Aid, proposed buying up Revco, the FTC and some state attorneys general challenged the buyout, saying it could create too much of a monopoly. That deal was called off, but this deal might spark fewer objections. CVS officials note there's little geographical overlap right now with Revco stores, In fact, that's the main reason Ohio's attorney general, which fought the Rite Aid Revco deal, does not plan to fight this buyout. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Investors who want to check out the background of their stockbrokers may now be at a bit of a disadvantage. The Wall Street Journal reports much of that information was accidentally wiped out. The deleted information includes disciplinary actions that have been taken against brokers. The paper says the error that purged as many as 20,000 pieces of information was made by the National Association of Securities Dealers. That's the group that acts as the self-regulator for the brokerage industry. Again, on Wall Street, the Dow's up more than 73 points. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of the changing relationship between family and workplace.
Fresh Air support comes from William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Lots of middle-aged people considered it quite a victory when George Foreman recaptured the world heavyweight title in November 1994 at the age of 45. He was 24 when he first won the title in a fight against Joe Frazier back in 1973. He lost the title to Muhammad Ali in 1974 in Zaire in a fight that was billed as the Rumble in the Jungle. That fight is documented in the new film When We Were Kings, which opens next week. 3 years after losing that fight, Foreman lost another fight, had a religious experience, and retired from boxing to take up preaching. He was ordained in 1978 and soon after started his own church and youth center in Houston. Foreman says he re-entered the ring in 1987 because he needed money. I spoke to Foreman in 1995 after the publication of his autobiography, By George. He still held the title then, but he's since lost it for refusing to fight a challenger. Last November, he fought and won a non-title bout. Anger used to motivate him in the ring. I asked him what motivated him as a preacher in his late 40s.
Yeah, I had this killing instinct. I had built up over the years from my life. I'd consider everything that bad had happened to me, what people had done to me, and I would that would be my motivating thing to get in the ring and hate this guy and try to kill him. Now, 10 years later, 20 years later, after I'm no longer a champion, I've been going back into boxing, and I've got to win. And I quit boxing in 77 because I no longer had this killing instinct. So I started teaching kids at the youth center to box, get a chip off the shoulder. Don't try to hurt anybody. You don't need to be angry. Boxing is good for you, but don't hurt anybody. So I learned, by teaching, I learned, too, how to pursue boxing and never a punch or shot in anger.
But you're hitting and you're hurting the person, whether it's in anger or not. So as a religious man, how did you feel about re-entering the ring, knowing whether you were motivated by anger or not? You were still delivering blows and you know, hopefully knockout blows.
It became then a profession to me, and it became a sport where you practice hard, and the other guy that you're facing, he practiced hard. It's a sport. You hug prior to the boxing match. There's no longer this staring down. And no matter what you do, the most safest thing that you can have in a boxing ring is not a headgear, like I say all the time, but compassion for the guy, knowing when, hey, you can't hurt this guy anymore. Winning the fight and not hurting the guy. And believe me, in boxing, it's the granddaddy of even chess. Man, hand-to-hand, man-to-man, woman against woman or whatever, there's nothing wrong with boxing. It's the granddaddy of all sports. I mean, to ping pong itself, without boxing, it never would have been a game of ping pong.
You talk about compassion. Can you tell me a time when you were in the ring when you didn't do something you could have done out of compassion for your opponent?
Oh, a lot of times I've been almost beat up because once you cross that road, when you knew the guys, you know a guy, I've had too much, I've hit him too much, and you tell a referee, hey, he's had enough, ref. I'm not going to kill this guy. And then the ref doesn't stop the fight. He tells me, go on, but I know I've hurt this guy. So once you make that point where you're not going to hurt him anymore, you can't jump into that boat again. Then the guy starts hitting me, and he knows, hey, George is not going to hurt me. I've had this happen to me so many times.
So you let somebody hit you rather than...
Well, I try to get out of the way because I ease up. I gauge my punches, not only to win, but to make sure I don't hurt a guy. And the guy can feel that, and he goes off on you. So it's happened to me a lot.
How can you tell that your opponent is at the point where if you hit him hard, you will deliver a serious blow and hurt him.
Well, there's a look of, please have mercy on me, that they won't show the referee. They won't show their corner, but it's there. They have this heart, and they don't want the world to know either, that I just can't take it anymore. I wish I could quit, but I can't. And you got to see that, because I've experienced it myself. I know how it is, and I can look and see, hey, this is it. Now I better change. He's not going to quit. He's not going down. I'm his only, and there's an old Bible saying, the merciful will obtain mercy. So I always try to extend that merciful hand.
No, back to compassion. You say you've developed compassion mm-hmm. in the ring. Does that ever get in the way?
Not for me, because once you're out of boxing, you want that to rule your life. I never get into the ring and I want to be a split personality. What you see is what you get. And I tell my kids all the time, because they're watching me, I'm in the ring. I don't want them to see one daddy at home who's picking him up, loving him, and kissing him, and another guy in the ring who's frowning, who's mean, staring a guy down. I am the same guy no matter what. And so nothing ever gets in my way because I'm the same guy. But if I try to this metamorphosis of transforming myself into this character and then recreating him after the fight is over, things would get in the way.
George Foreman is my guest, and he has a new autobiography. Is it harder to take blows and to take pain now in your mid-40s than it was when you started boxing?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think the years have enabled me to be a lot stronger. Because you focus, you note, hey, I'm doing it for a reason now. When I was younger, I didn't understand pain. When things hurt, they hurt, and you try to stay away from them. But as a man, you know why you're doing it, the reason you're doing it, and the pain is lesser for some reason.
Because you know why you're doing it?
Or you know why.
Is there something else you know, too, now about how to deal with pain?
You understand that without the old saying, no pain, no gain. It's no slogan anymore to me. It's about life itself.
Do you feel more vulnerable in your mid-40s than you used to? That a blow could do more serious damage than it could? Or that you'll heal more slowly than you used to?
Not at all. I figure that I feel like I'm the standard bearer for the 21st century. As we move into another century, someone has got to take us into. We won't be able to say, going into a new century, you're an old man, you're 35. Someone has got to lead us into the promised land. And one day, someone is going to have to say, hey, everybody can pursue dreams. I'm in that demographic of 45, 55. This will never be able to, no one will ever be able to erase that I was heavyweight champ of the world, not on the seniors tour, heavyweight champ of the world at 45. I'm 46 now, of course. And it's something that I'm going to wipe away the fear of being hurt, the fear of it can't be done. You know, Olympians, basketball players, even cheerleaders are going to be active beyond 40 because of what we're doing now.
Now, let me flip back a bunch of years and get back to when you were a teenager. You started off as a street fighter. Mm-hmm. How did that affect your approach to boxing when you started to box?
Devastating, because I met Doc Brodus, my first boxing coach, in 66 in the Job Corps Center. I said, hey, I want to be a boxer. He said, okay, you're big enough, you're ugly enough, come on down to the gym. I remember going down to the gym, and he put me in a ring with a little guy, a little skinny guy, no muscles. You can see his ribs. I said, boy, I invited all my friends to watch my boxing match. I thought it was going to be just like on the streets. Jumped in the ring. I never was able to land one blow. The guy would move out of the way and hit me with this thing called a jab. And I'd charge him and try to grab him, and the referees would say, you can't wrestle. So it was a hard thing to abandon my street fighting tactics and move into another thing where I had to learn how to do box. I had to learn a new style, a whole new existence of fighting.
What was the hardest thing to give up from your street fighting style?
Grabbing. In the streets, I'd hit you and hit you. If you move out of the way, I would grab you and get you. In the ring, you were not able to, you can only use your fist. You can't open your hand and grab anyone. Plus, I wanted to bite too, but you had a mouthpiece.
Now, what about the kind of finesse that your trainer was trying to teach you?
Yeah, it was a long time before I could really comprehend what he was saying. George, you're not going to be able to just knock everybody out and run over everybody. You're going to have to learn this sport. And it took a few defeats before I decided I had to dedicate my life to learning more than just being powerful and strong. I had to learn this as a sport, jabbing and finesse, as you call it.
Did you used to psych yourself up before you entered the ring to get yourself to be really angry or to really hate your opponent?
Yeah, Dick Sattler, my first trainer, manager, in 69, I told him I wanted to be a boxer. He said he would teach me how to be a boxer, and I'd move in the ring and practice every day, styles, dancing, prancing, and I really wanted to be the next Muhammad Ali, that kind of stuff. So my first boxing match in Madison Square Garden, 1969, Donald Waldheim. Dick Sattler gets me into the dressing room. He rubs me down. He takes water away from me for 2 days. Then he starts cussing. This blankety blank is trying to stop your life. You go out there, and I mean, you knock him out. You hit him here. If he hides, you hit him behind. And he cusses and cusses and cusses. You hear me? Push him like this. And he asks me to push him, and I pushes him. By the time I get into that ring, I'm like a wind-up killer. And I thought he was going to let me be a boxer. From that point on, he would wind me up like a doll every time. It was not about my psyching myself up. He would engineer this creature.
Was that effective for you?
Oh, yes. When I got into that ring, sorry for a guy who didn't know how to protect himself. I remember boxing a guy, I think maybe in Seattle, Washington. I can't remember his name. We're a match, and I jumped out on this kid, and I tried to hit him, and I missed him. I tried to hit him again. I'd miss him. I'd hit him in the back. Finally, I barely missed him, and he hit the floor. People threw candy wrappers, cigarette butts. They were booing. I said, get up, man. Get up. Don't do this. And later on after the fight, he walked up to me, and he saw I was really feeling down about what happened. They counted him out, but he wasn't out. He looked me in the eye. He said, you know, you really want to kill someone, don't you? He said, that's what you wanted. You wanted to kill me. He said, I wasn't going to get up for you to kill me.
Huh.
Do you understand? So I had this killer instinct, and it wasn't. And the sad thing, I'm upset with a guy because he won't get up and let me kill him. And for the first time, I realized that the best thing he could have done was just stay down there.
Now, so you got really psyched up with this killing instinct to get into the ring. Could you turn that off when a match was over?
You know, it's strange because you think you can turn it off, but later on, you're fighting once, twice, sometimes three times in a month. You go home and you say to yourself, it's over now, I'm going to go back. Finally, this stuff follows you around all the time. And if you're not careful, people see the best side of you in the ring. The awful side of you is outside of the ring. As you get closer, I'm having knockout after knockout. I'm starting to look at myself in the mirror. I see this body. I see this face. I see this man who's going to be heavyweight champ of the world. He is the king of men. He can beat anybody in the room. And you get into a room with guys and you start thinking, nobody can whip me. So it wasn't something you could turn on and off. It was something that stayed with you all the time, as a matter of fact. I remember winning a championship of the world. I defeated Joe Frazier. And I remember thinking, I can beat anybody in the world. Anybody. And it followed me around from restaurant, everywhere I would go.
How did that get in the way of things?
It got in the way of my life because I no longer had a life. I mean, I wouldn't meet a friend. I was like, I'm meeting people that I could whip. You know,
right.
Size you up. You know you can't whip me, don't you? Hi. You know you can't whip me. So you lose a life because 24 hours a day you are the heavyweight champ of the world in your mind.
And how did that affect your relationship with women?
Same way. Hey, you're with the best man. You're with the men of men. You're with the best man. You're with the strongest, toughest, mightiest man in the world. And you felt like that. That's why I was so crumbling when I was defeated by Muhammad Ali. I was knocked out in 74. I'd never lost a boxing match as a professional. Counted out. It was like, man, I'm ashamed to go into the room with people now. They're going to know I'm not the best. You get in a room with a woman, and she knows. She knows that I'm not the best. Maybe I should keep my clothes on. You know, this not only beats you, it's like you are stripped of your manhood.
Because all you were was the best, right?
All I was the heavyweight, the best. And now there's someone better, and they all know. You figure I'm going to keep my clothes on. Oh, I'm going to put on some dog glasses so they won't know who I am, so they can say, you know, there's one better than you. Like the old saying, mirror, mirror on the wall. And the mirror speak back, oh, there's someone else. I had to live through that, and it devastated my life. I felt like I, you know, it was the most devastating thing that ever happened to me, because when I lost the title to Muhammad Ali, I felt like I lost my manhood, what I considered manhood.
Now, would you feel that way if you lost a bout now?
Oh, no. It was, I fought Ronnie Lyles back in 76 after losing the title. Because I told people I could have gotten up in the ring in Africa. I could have done this. I could have won. You look for every excuse. But there I am in Caesar's Palace. Ronnie Lyles, a big, strong guy, knocked me down. I'm bleeding on the canvas. I jump up. He knocks me down again. Then I knock him down. He has me on the floor bleeding. Finally, after beating the count two or three times, I knock him out. I felt restored again. Like, oh, I'm a man again. It wasn't Muhammad Ali, but I had my manhood again. I believed in myself a little bit. And I thought that people said, oh, George is tough now. So I got it back. Eventually, I lost to Jimmy Young in 77, and I found something even greater than manhood. I found God, you see. And he gave me something. I was able to admit I lost a boxing match and found a little peace within myself. And it has nothing to do with winning a boxing match or losing anything. It's peace of mind.
We're featuring a 1995 interview with two-time world heavyweight champion George Foreman. His 1974 championship fight against Muhammad Ali is the subject of the new documentary When We Were Kings, which opens next week. We'll hear more from Foreman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1995 interview with George Foreman. What's the worst blow you ever took?
It happened in divorce court. When the judge said, 50-50, boy. No, but literally, the Ronnie Lyles fight in 76, he hit me so hard, it didn't even hurt. And that's probably the worst you can be hit. It doesn't hurt, because you don't say to yourself, I'm going to stay out of his way. That didn't hurt. You just see, I'm going to get up on your knees and say, no, you're not. Your legs won't bring you up. And then you're bleeding. How did that happen? I'm not hurt. That was the worst thing that could ever happen.
Did you get up?
Of course. I had to get up two times. But eventually I won the boxing match. If it was physical pain, I probably would not have gotten up. You know, someone threw and hit you with a rock on the bone. You say, ouch. And you say, I'm going to hide. But this guy would hit so hard that you were on the floor. You were on the canvas.
Now, what's the blow that hurt the most that you took?
I've never actually been hurt in the ring, and I'll tell you that. Never been hurt. Once I sparred with a guy, and I remember he had a headgear on, forearms. His forearms looked like Popeye the Sailor Man. He was not strong looking at all, but he would throw his fist on your headgear. It felt like someone threw a brick. Like, I'm not going to spar with this guy anymore. I'm paying him to hurt me? No way. But that was the worst I've had. But I've never actually been hurt at all. I bumped head with guys or something that causes you to swell up, and it makes it look like you're in pain, but never. I've never had any true pain. I've never lost one tooth so far.
You've been knocked out.
I was knocked down in Africa by Muhammad Ali. When he knocked me down, I stayed on the canvas waiting for the count of eight. When I jumped up, the referee counted me out. But I was never out.
You lost your title in 77, I guess it was.
I lost the title in 74.
74,
Zaire,
I'm sorry, yeah, right.
To Muhammad Ali.
How did Ali change boxing for you? I don't mean losing the title, but his sense of showmanship and his sense of theatrics for the media. Did that change what you felt you needed to do as a boxer?
Not at all. As a matter of fact, during the time I was in boxing, I really pledged that I would be opposite of Muhammad Ali. I didn't like what he did. I didn't like what he stood for, what he was standing for. I didn't like anything about Muhammad Ali. I would hate anybody even trying to be like this guy. And his approach was nice and comical, but at the same time, he would, like, call a guy a rabbit or a bear. I make sure I never tease or say anything about anybody.
Well, what else didn't you like about Ali's approach?
Oh, I mean, when I was coming up,
yeah,
I just didn't like Muhammad Ali after a while. I was a fan early on, but then I just didn't like the guy. I just didn't like him. I mean, he was he whipped me. That's number two. But as a rule, when I got back in the boxing the second time, I started to admire him as a man, of course, because of the sacrifices he had taken early on when other guys were doing anything to get a commercial for a soda pop company. Muhammad Ali decided, hey, I want to speak up and I'm going to be a man. I'm going to say and express myself and express what I see in this world. And he sacrificed everything. And even today when I see people ask me about his injuries, I tell them about World War II veterans, you know, who've been in the war, and you're sitting there with them talking, and they'll take off part of their leg and say, oh, I lost this in North Africa. Take off an arm. I lost this, da-da-da-da. You know, they're proud of it because it was for a reason. Now, when I see Muhammad Ali, I don't see a guy that you should feel sorry for. In his mind, I did something. I'm hurt, sure, but I did it for a reason. I see a hero to a lot of people, and I'll never knock him. I don't believe in half the things he talked about. I don't even understand them. But this man is a hero.
Now, you said that when you lost to Ali in 74, that you weren't knocked out. You were just staying down to the count of eight, but when you got up, the referee...
See, we were told, as a fighter, Archie Moore was one of my trainers, and Dick Sattler was his previous trainer and corner man. If you're knocked down, there wasn't any mandatory eight count as there is now. No matter if you're knocked down, you get up, you still have to be counted eight, clear your head up. This time in Africa, they tell me, when you're knocked down, always look to your corner. Don't listen to the referee. Let your corner count. Get your head clear. Then when the corner tell you to get up, get up. So I was knocked down, and I looked around and found my corner. They told me to stay down, which is what they're supposed to do. Then they tell me, when they told me to jump up, I jumped up. The fight was over. But I was never out, never. I started thinking, All night I've pursued Muhammad Ali. He covered up with the rope-a-dope. He wouldn't mix it up. I could knock him out if he only mixes it up. And I'm on the floor thinking, now he's going to come out for the kill and try to finish me off. I'm going to knock him out now. That's what I was waiting to do. When I jumped up, they said it was over. The referee counted quick.
So you're angry?
Oh, I was devastated. I'd wake up in the night sweating, thinking, why didn't I just get up? Why did I trust my corner?
What'd you say to the people in your corner? What did you say to the people in your corner?
I fired them. I never worked with them again.
George Foreman, recorded in 1995. We'll hear the rest of our interview in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I get to Africa, we gonna get it on because we don't get alone. I will eat him up.
George Foreman lost the heavyweight title to Muhammad Ali in 1974 in Zaire. That fight is the subject of the new documentary When We Were Kings. Coming up on Fresh Air, we continue our 1995 interview with George Foreman. And film critic John Powers reviews Suburbia and Waiting for Guffman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with former heavyweight champion of the world, George Foreman. He first won the title in 1973, lost it in 74 to Muhammad Ali in Zaire. That fight is the subject of the new documentary, When We Were Kings, which opens next week. Foreman retired from boxing in 77, started a comeback in 87, and regained the title in 1995 at the age of 45. He since lost the title for refusing to fight challengers. Let's get back to our interview with Foreman, recorded in 95 when he still held the title. Now, let me get to 1977, which is the year you gave up fighting, after a bout with Jimmy Young in Puerto Rico. That's the night that you found God. What happened?
Well, it was a 12-round fight, and I wanted to prove to the world that I not only could whip Muhammad Ali, but I had stamina. They said I lost to Muhammad because I didn't have stamina. So I had Jimmy Young in trouble early on in the fight, and I let him off the hook because even my trainer said, "Now, George." I said, "Nope, I'm going to knock him out later on." But after 10 rounds, I couldn't get him. As a matter of fact, he knocked me down once. He was so shocked, he still ran from me. But after 12 rounds, they gave the decision to Jimmy Young. But I felt victorious because I'd proven I could go 12 rounds. Went back into the dressing room. It was extremely hot that night. No air condition, no hot shower back there, nothing. So I had to walk and cool off. And I had this experience as I walked and cooled. Yeah, you got everything. You don't care about this boxing match. You could go home right now to your ranch and retire and die. It sneaked into my conversation. I didn't put it there. And I kept wondering, how did that get in there? After a while, I was overwhelmed with, you're going to die. I heard about athletes dying after exertion, football, basketball, or whatever, baseball. I wasn't prepared to die. I knew about religion. I just didn't believe in it. It was for poor people who didn't have anything. When I grew up, you see a guy, police shoot him, or you get hit in the head, get a plate in his head. Then you see him in the church. Whenever a woman would have some devastation, she'd be a good dancer, and then if something happened bad, she's in church. So it was for weak people. And I talked about there was a God somewhere. I just didn't believe in religion. So I'm there fighting in that room trying to, I said, I'm not going to die. I've got everything to live for. And I heard a voice right within my thoughts. You believe in God? Why are you scared to die? Sure, everybody believe in God, but I'm not going to die in a dressing room. I started exercising, trying to keep my life in me, walking back and forward. I'm not going to die. And I remember, I'm going to make a deal. Everybody likes money. Because I knew now that these were not my thoughts. I said, I'm still George Foreman. I can box and give money to charities and help cancer. And the voice answered right within my thoughts. I don't want your money. I want you. There's nobody I've ever met turning down money. And that changed my life. I was fighting for my life. In a split second, I remember my legs giving out on me. And I remember saying, God, I believe in you. Before I could say another word, I was in a deep, dark nothing. Over my head, under my feet, I was nothing. I existed no more. And this horrible smell that goes along with it, I was dead. In this vision, I was like a man dropped off into the sea with no ships or nowhere. And I said, well, I talked about there being a God. I said, I don't care if this is death. I still believe there's a God. And it was like a giant hand, when I said that, reached into this nothing and pulled me out. And I was alive in this dressing room with blood flowing through my veins. I'd been dead, and I was alive. And everybody standing over me, evidently picking me off the floor, laid me on the table. And I remember saying, I'm dying, but tell everybody I'm dying for God. And everybody's like, George, you can win another boxing match. Don't worry about it. I said, I'm not worrying about a boxing match. And as I laid on that table, my doctor who traveled with me, evidently holding my head, I told him, move your hands, Dr. West. The thorns on his head are making him bleed. I didn't believe in this stuff. And I told my masseur, move your hand, Mr. Fuller. He's bleeding where they crucified him. Next thing you know, I'm fighting in the room, trying to take a shower, saying words like, I'm born again. Hallelujah, I'm clean. And I haven't stopped telling that story since 1977. It changed my life. To explain it, I haven't gotten that smart yet.
When you say you thought you were dying then, was that because of blows you took in the ring, or was it something unrelated to what happened in the ring?
Oh, later on, I remember everybody knew something had happened to me in the dressing room. They rushed me to the hospital. They put me in intensive care. They never found anything wrong with me. And so my trainer, manager, one of my trainers came in, Gil Clancy. He said, George, I've told the press that you have heat prostration. Never heard the word. I said, how do you say that? Heat prostration. He said, when they come into the room, say it. I said, I don't know how to say it. We practiced a few times. Then the reporters came in. I said, I got heat prostration. before I forgot how to pronounce it or say it. Never heard of the word, but I was thinking of excuses too. Maybe I was hit too hard. Maybe I went without water. Maybe I, anything, but not what happened to me. This had not, I'm a champion. I'm a playboy. I got a life ahead of me. I'm not into religion. I try to shake this out of my mind.
So when you found religion, did you feel like you needed to give up boxing?
Well, I had this rage that motivated me to become champ of the world. I wanted to kill somebody and beat everybody. When I left that room, I thought about, in this experience that I had in that room, I'm about to die. And the only thing that came to my mind, I had not said goodbye to my mother. And I had a little baby. You know, I hadn't said goodbye to my children. I'm dead in this dirty old nasty dressing room. I got homes and cars all over the world. I'm going to die in this dirty dressing room without saying bye. You understand? And all my life I'd pursued and wanted people to show me that they loved me and cared about me. And here I am in this moment. All I wanted to do was say goodbye. So in this room, I left out that night not wanting people to love me. I said, I got another chance to live and let people know I love them. And it changes your whole life. I got to rush home and hug my mother. I got to rush home and say, tell my kids I love them and my sisters, my brothers, hi. You know, I forgot, I left them with a frown on my face thinking I was going to see them again. So, excuse me, I'm turned backwards. My whole life is turned up. I'm in a rush now to go out and change things. So there was no time for a killer instinct or to get psyched up.
Now, this story that you told about how you didn't used to, you not only didn't used to believe, but you used to think religion was for weak people.
It was, to me.
I bet you tell that story to people all the time. I bet you told that story a lot to other people who think, like you once thought, that religion is for weak people.
Yeah, I really did. I remember thinking of a guy, you know, with a Bible. He has to be someone who can't fight. I can fight. You go up in school and you see a kid go to school and he has a strange look on him. His parents take him to church. He's not allowed to fight. You could take his lunch money. You could do anything to this kid. You know, I'm not going to turn into that. So I tell this story over and over why I just didn't see how religion could fit into a winner's life.
We'll get back to our 1995 interview with George Foreman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Foreman. You grew up in poverty.
Mm-hmm.
When you were really young, like before you were 16, you would rob, you'd mug people, steal money. And you said you really had no conscience.
No.
Back then. Is there a turning point where you felt like you developed a conscience, where you developed empathy for the people who you might have been mugging a few years before?
It's strange because ignorance... It's almost sad because if you get into a life of poverty, you're almost married to ignorance. Not having a book, not having a proper role models, it's the worst thing that could happen to human beings. So there I am running the street, mugging people as a teenager, robbing, stealing, just to buy wine and cigarettes because everybody is doing it, not because I'm a criminal. One night the police chased me. I had to run under a house to hide. And I covered myself with mud so the dogs wouldn't sniff me out. And I remembered a criminal running from the police on a TV show, going into the water so the dogs couldn't sniff him. It was my only education. Hey, man, you're a criminal. I didn't want to be that. I didn't want to be a criminal. I was just robbing people, if you know what I mean. But it was that recognition that I was a criminal that I crawled from under that house at about 15. I said, I'll never steal again. I'm not a criminal. If you know what I mean. So embracing and growing up in ignorance is probably greater than poverty because even ignorance can embrace someone with money. And I was ignorant thinking that I was hurting people. And so the idea that I was a criminal made me start to say, hey, well, if you're not a criminal, you wouldn't hurt people. You wouldn't take their money. It changed me right then. You could lay $1,000 in front of me at that point. I was not going to touch it because I felt like, hey, you're covering yourself with mud again. And I didn't want to be covered in my life with mud. That little television show, you know, it's very important that kids are educated and in any kind of way they can about what is right and what is wrong. I think that today the prisons are loaded with kids who are there and don't even know why. It's real.
What's your ministry like now?
Well, I still preach love. The doctrine that I preach is about love. I'm an evangelist, which means I go to certain towns and there are a lot of people will come out to auditoriums and buildings to hear me talk. And I talk about Jesus. That's all it is to sell this product that I use. I mean, I never go out selling one product and smelling like another. I love this, and I try to tell people about peace of mind, and you can only find it with the recognition and belief that God is alive and that his son is too. And that's all it is about. And, of course, I devote myself to a lot of time going out speaking to kids, unrelated to church work, just inspiring them to believe in their country, that if you really want something, this is the most compassionate society, and it never gives up on its underprivileged.
Is it true that all of your sons are named George?
We have four boys, all named George Edward Foreman.
Why'd you name them all George?
That was a pretty good name.
Okay.
You were trying to talk about my name? Take that. No, but literally, I didn't find out who my biological father was until after I had lost the title of the world. I had already had taste devastation. Then one sister came up to me and said, you know, Daddy is not your daddy. I said, what do you mean? You want to fight? Said, nope. And I had to search and find this guy, and I only became friends with him. We were friends maybe, I don't know, for 2 years, and he was dead. I didn't know anything about that man. And I figured I better do something. All my boys, I'm not going to one junior and then another. I'm going to name them all George Foreman. They're going to have to sort it out and understand more about it as they get older. But I had to, when you can't find roots, plant something. And George is a good root.
Now, one last question. When you learned how to box, did it teach you things beyond boxing? Did it expose you early on to things, you know, to things you felt you would have otherwise than you never have known about or been exposed to?
Oh, boxing really helped me. Like all sports, you get a chance to travel.
Discipline.
Meet other people. You know, hey, I got to go to sleep.
Mm-hmm, right.
If you're going to make it big, you got to give up smoking and drinking.
Mm-hmm.
It opened up a whole nother world for me. As a matter of fact, you'd be lonely hours. You pick up a book, start to read books. A whole world, because you got so much time on your hand. You don't want to waste it.
The greatest thing
it introduced me to was a book.
What books made a big impression on you?
Mostly autobiographies.
And
little self-help things.
Uh-huh.
Basic mathematics, business law. Here I am. The points where you put a zero behind a zero became very important to me. Percentages. You know, if you don't know, they would take your money.
Right.
And one period in the wrong spot could mean a difference between you having a egg sandwich or a steak sandwich. So you have to start studying and learning out things. No one was there to look out for you but your own self. Books became my love, my life.
George Foreman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Two-time heavyweight champion George Foreman recorded in 1995. He since lost the title for refusing to fight challengers. The new documentary about the 1974 fight in which he lost the title to Muhammad Ali in Zaire is called When We Were Kings. It opens next week. The biggest trend in film comedy is the ensemble piece. Two new ones are Suburbia and Waiting for Guffman. Our film critic John Powers finds one tart and the other sweet and tells us which he enjoyed more.
When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, the theater screens were filled with stories about the soullessness of suburban life. America's suburbs have changed a lot since then, but not the movies, which never tire of condescending to the burbs. The new movie, Suburbia, focuses on an unlikely group of 20-year-old friends who spend one whole night hanging around a convenience store run by a Pakistani couple. There's the loutish Buff, the faded athlete Tim, fresh-faced Suze who dreams of New York, and lonely Bibi, awash in self-destruction. On this particular night, the group's tired routine is broken by the sudden appearance of their old classmate Pony, a one-time geek who's now on tour as a rock star. Pony cometh like the Iceman, his presence unmasking his friend's illusions. Suburbia began as a play by Eric Bogosian, who's been widely hailed for exposing the scabrously funny underbelly of the American dream. Beats me why, Bogosian creates caricatures unsullied by any genuine social observation. The young people in this movie aren't really mid-American suburban kids with homes and families and shared experiences. No, they're a New York performance artist's idea of suburban kids. Bogosian either turns his characters into easy targets that the audience can snicker at, or, in what is obviously his idea of empathy, he makes them pathetic. He always lets us feel superior to the people we're watching, as when Buff explains what he'd do if he were a rock star.
If I were in his shoes every morning, I'd get up singing, man. I'd do my workout, take a shower, followed by a hearty breakfast, steak and eggs, washed down with a pot of hot coffee, six-pack of Coors Light. Then I'd order my bodyguard to go find my babe, who would appear decked out in her all-black leather Victoria's Secret custom-made bodysuit. So I'd like have to chew off all her clothes until she was completely nude. Except she'd have these amazing dragon tattoos all over her body, pierced nipples with little gold peace signs hanging from them. And then she'd take out this half ounce of blow, we'd snap out a few Mongo lines, vaporize a few million brain cells, for about an hour, then spend the rest of the morning trashed watching Gilligan.
Suburbia is partly redeemed by Richard Linklater, who's best known for Slackers and Before Sunrise, who directs the story with classic fluidity and directness. Unlike Bogosian, Linklater understands these characters, and he cares for them all, whether they're philosophizing like dime store Nietzsche's or braying obscenely into the beery night. This sympathy lets him earn a series of uniformly terrific performances, most notably from Giovanni Ribisi, who plays the self-conscious Jeff, the moral hinge on which the action swings. Still, Olestra isn't olive oil, however you package it, and in the end there's something deeply phony about Suburbia. It was made by a director who loves people, but written by a man who holds them in contempt. There's no such contradiction in the wonderfully silly Waiting for Guffman, a fake documentary made by Christopher Guest, one of the masterminds behind This Is Spinal Tap, where he played guitarist Nigel Tufnell. Here he stars as Corky St. Clair, an obviously gay and just as obviously talentless theater director transplanted from Manhattan to the small town of Blaine, Missouri. As part of Blaine's sesquicentennial celebration, Corky's staging a musical about the town's history. His cast includes various local luminaries, played by such scene-stealers as Eugene Levy, Fred Willard, Catherine O'Hara, and the scintillating Parker Posey, the queen of low-budget movies. Although Corky and company long to attract New York talent scouts, their dreams of the big time keep bumping up against reality, as when Corky goes to the city council to ask for more money.
What I need from you, because you're the bosses of the town, essentially, and I know that, is... This is so hard. I mean, there's nothing easy about this. Mm. You know, this is like, you know, when you're getting your legs waxed and they whip that thing off real fast. That's what this is like. I need more money.
Wow. Wow.
How much do you need?
That's, Steve's right. How much are you thinking of now?
Okay. What I need is $100,000.
Oh, brother!
He's not kidding.
Corky, our entire budget for the entire year is $15,000 for everything, and that includes swimming.
Compared to Suburbia, Waiting for Guffman is ragged filmmaking. But it made me laugh from beginning to end. And more important, it never falls into meanness. Although Corky and the citizens of Blaine are comical figures, the movie never mocks them. In fact, the genial offbeat tone recalls some of the Czech comedies of the 1960s, which loved their characters because of their follies, not despite them. This is never more obvious than in the handling of Corky, who's so blatantly queenie that I worried he might become an extended fag joke. But the effect is just the opposite. Guest plays Corky with such tenderness and precision that we come to see him as an adorably foolish dreamer, one made all the more enjoyable because the people of Blaine have no inkling that he's gay. While Waiting for Guffman never reaches the inspired heights of This Is Spinal Tap, I still recommend it highly, as much for its gentleness as its oddball humor. At a time when most film comedies are filled with snideness, cruelty, or people breaking wind. This movie's sweetness is an unexpected treat, like being herded onto a crowded airplane and finding that you've been seated next to a dear friend you haven't seen for years.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Coming up, a preview of our concert and interview with Rosemary Clooney. This is Fresh Air. I want to remind you of a special program we have coming up next Tuesday with Rosemary Clooney. It's a kind of singing autobiography in which I talk with her about different chapters of her life, and she sings songs that connect to those chapters. This onstage event was recorded last month in San Francisco as part of the City Arts and Lectures series. Our only problem with this program is that there are more good songs and stories than we'll have time for on Tuesday. But we didn't want you to miss this. I'm going to ask you to sing a song that is one of the many songs you've sung that I've heard differently after you sang it. And the song is Falling in Love Again, a song that is considered to be owned by Marlene Dietrich, who
Absolutely.
Is a very close friend of yours.
Yes.
And, of course, you do it very differently than she did. What inspired you to do the song yourself? And tell us a little bit about your approach to it, if you could.
I have to tell you about Dietrich first.
Please.
Okay. See...
What an unlikely combination.
Well, now, isn't that the truth? Isn't that just the truth? Maysville, Kentucky, and Berlin. Perfect, you know. You know, an icon from the golden age of movies. And somebody that sings pop songs. It's, she was wonderful. She was wonderful to me. When I got the job at Paramount, when I was going to go there, I called her up and I said, I'm gonna go be working at Paramount. She said, you know, I used to work there. She made Paramount, you know. She was the one who subsidized everything that else that went on there. I said, yes, I know you did. And she said, well, suppose I send a couple of letters of introduction for you, which is so sweet, you know. So I thought that she'd probably write to the front office, or maybe Wally Westmore or Edith Head or somebody, you know, like that. But she wrote to everybody. She wrote to the guys that work on, she wrote to cinematographers, she wrote to guys that plaster, you know, make, you know, just everybody, the head of every department got a letter from her saying, take care of my friend.
So what did they do to help you?
Well, they just, listen, if Dietrich said take care of it, that meant, you know, okay, the best hairdresser that was on staff, I got. And the best makeup man that was available, I got, because she did that. But there was a funny thing that happened about 7 weeks after I was at the studio. This guy was moving a mountain for DeMille, you know, rolling it across. And he was the gang boss, obviously. He said, hold it. So he came up to me and he said, everything all right? I said, yeah, everything's just fine, thanks. He said, well, I got a letter from the crowd. And I just wanted to be sure everything was okay.
So now you have to tell us about singing Falling in Love Again, why you chose to do it, and what you think of your approach to the song.
When she would, it was done as an anthem when she would come on the stage and when she would leave it. And sometimes she'd sing it and sometimes she wouldn't. And sometimes she'd kind of burlesque it, sing it with not, you know, much of her original intent. But when she sang it, just sweetly, and sometimes ironically, it was the best way it was sung.
And the way you sing it, we'll hear.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help it. Love's always been my game, play it how I may. I was made that way. Can't help it. Men cluster to me as moths around a flame, and if their wings burn, I'm really not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help it. Never wanted to. What am I to do? Can't help it. What am I to do? I can't help it. That was Marlena. Really.
Rosemary Clooney recorded last month. We'll hear more of that concert and interview Tuesday on our show. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shirock, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tenenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the multi-billion dollar porn industry. One estimate suggests that one in every five videos rented is hardcore. We'll talk with Eric Schlosser, who wrote the U.S. News & World Report cover story on the business of pornography. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.